when you're strong enough to open your heart. 2. What does love mean to you? Is it just a good feeling? Is it companionship? Is it comfort? Is it direction for the future? 3. How could you possibly get those things in your life if not through the company and proclamation of undying intimacy from someone you probably don't even know yet? 4. If the love of your life would reflect all of your unhealed issues, mirror your flaws, and bring your deepest insecurities to light, would you be ready to be in a relationship with them? 5. Do you try to relate to other human beings, or do you try to exert superiority over them? Do you want to connect, or do you want to seem impressive? Do you engage in discussion to learn, or to sell someone on your way of thinking so you feel supported and correct? 6. Are you thinking about your love life more than you're actually living it? Have you developed a plan to find the kind of love you think you are so desperately missing? 7. If you were to develop a plan to find that kind of love, what would it look like? What would you need to do? What could you try? Where could you go? 8. Is the prospect of online dating, being set up by friends, and generally putting yourself out there less comfortable than the idea that you could possibly spend the next few years, or longer, by yourself? 9. Are you open about the fact that you're looking for love? If you're trying to play it like you're cool being single, you're going to miss out on a lot of opportunities to meet friends of friends simply because they don't know you're willing. 10. What makes you happy, aside from affection from other people? 11. If you decided to take control of your relationship destiny today, as opposed to just waiting for it to happen when it's meant to, what would you start doing differently? 12. Do you think a great relationship is something you find, or something you develop and strengthen over time? 13. Do you believe that people who are more beautiful, successful, smart, talented, or in other ways superior, have more love than you ever could? 14. Have you ever taken an honest look at the people around you who have love, and evaluated them on that same scale of attractiveness and intelligence and superiority? 15. If you did that, what would you find? 16. Would it blow your mind to learn that relationships aren't just nice? They are the stitching that keeps the patchwork of this entire damn world together, and that spending as much time and energy on them as you would anything else that matters would not only be essential, but crucial to you fulfilling your highest purpose as a human being. 17. Would it blow your mind to learn that even people who are surrounded by friends in seemingly happy relationships, with families to return to every holiday, and then some, are sometimes still cripplingly lonely, because it's a matter of how you connect, not who you have around? 18. Are you aware of what your needs are in a long-term relationship? 19. Are you willing to advocate for those needs if they aren't being met? Or would you forego doing so for the sake of seeming more likable to your partner? 20. If you find the relationship you've been dreaming of, and then it doesn't work out, what would your game plan be? 21. Would it surprise you to know that the most overlooked key to a happy, healthy relationship is the belief that even if said relationship dissolved, you could still carry on as a functioning, thriving human being? 22. Could it be possible that you're not alone right now because you're broken or unlovable, but because there's something profound and divine that you must discover, and it is only knowable through solitude? 23. If you knew that the love of your life was on their way, and that this time in your life was only temporary, what would you do with the nights you have alone? What would you invest your efforts in? Writing your book or scrolling through Facebook, developing relationships with friends, or envying people who have love, learning to meditate, or taking a swig of wine every time you feel the slightest bit uncomfortable. 24. Do you assume other people are doing you a favor by giving you love and spending time with you? 25. Do you ever think about the fact that they likely are just as hungry for love? 26. Do you ever think about what you can give to a relationship as opposed to what you want to take? 27. Are you committed to a lifetime of growing with and alongside another human being, or is your mental image of love something that allows and supports unconditional acceptance, that is, in reality, complacency? 28. Are you willing or ready to let go of every preconceived notion you had about how love would come, what it would look like, and what your partner would be like? You need to. 29. What are you willing to suffer for in this life? You suffer over your fears, your thoughts, your work. What about the one thing that's actually worth it? Are you willing to give it your all, fail a few times, and then reach the end, love commitment, only to find that dating was the walk before the run, the beginning of the real work? 30. Are you ready to let it gut you and help make you the person you were intended to be? 64. The most taboo thing in our culture is radical honesty, and that's exactly the problem. We are being suffocated by a culture and a people that, out of an irreverence for honesty, has grown an inability to coexist. We call opinions that aren't immediately harmonious with ours offensive, and use that word to make it wrong to see or hear them. Not to mention we're more offended by a woman's nipple and a swear word than we are half of the global atrocities of famine and war and the destruction of the environment. We police people into only saying and doing things that make sense to us. We grew up in a culture that taught us to put ourselves last, even when putting other people first is fake and disingenuous and rooted in resentment and dishonesty. We are all dying of some untouched, unrealized internal loneliness, grasping onto the bits of writing and music that speak in the way we otherwise cannot. We're suffering from anxiety and depression, and loneliness and uncertainty, and fear and failure, mostly because we have to continue to paint an outward picture of the opposite. The inability to realize those natural, crucial parts of life are what make them bad. Nobody's honest, and so nobody is finding anybody who loves them for them, because they aren't being who they are. They are only finding people who love their shells, which, as we all know, easily break. So many of our relationships hinge on whether or not we continually fulfill a set of expectations that we often know about, but sometimes do not. Our fear of honesty and change is rooted in no longer being acceptable or wanted or held in high regard by the people who claim to love us. We associate doing what we want and putting ourselves first with being selfish and with not considering others. We're taught that what we should want is what makes others happy. But do you want people in your life who secretly don't want to be there? Is it really surprising that we're all lost and scrambling and disconnected from ourselves when we're taught not to follow our instincts and truths for the sake of someone else's ego? No. It's not mean to tell the truth. We're just not used to hearing anything other than what we want to hear. We've talked anything that isn't coddling and placating and aligned with our most delusional and comforting thoughts to be wrong. Truthfulness and meanness have become synonymous because so long as people aren't doing and saying what we want to see and hear, they're wrong, and they're hurting our feelings by, subconsciously or not, making us feel unaccepted, unwanted, and invalidated, because we're only finding those things externally. What you have to keep in mind is that the people who shout the loudest about needing to behave a certain way are, undoubtedly, the very people who have most deeply and profoundly had their lives shaped by doing what other people wanted. They listened to the people who shouted loudly at them, and for that, they get emptiness. The very emptiness that their words are echoing through and out of. At our core, there is only light. I guarantee there is not one person you wouldn't love if you knew their true story, their whole story, if you lived a day or a year or a lifetime in their shoes. We can't expect equality when we're holding up facades of inequality through dishonesty. How can we expect people to treat all others as equals if they're constantly feeling beneath someone else? The root of equality and understanding equality of the human condition is being honest about it. The only way to change the course of our society, to enlighten the closed minds, to shift the way we perceive gender and race and humanity itself, is first and foremost by getting it all on the table. We are talking in circles and affirming only with people who inherently agree with us, rather than trying to understand where the people who don't are coming from. This is not change. This is ego steroids. There's so much value placed around helping others and being selfless, and forcing people to volunteer when they don't genuinely want to. The only kindness we grow and support is that which we force on other people, the sort we perceive as correct. Fake kindness is not worth it. It makes the world worse. It is the root of resentment and ill will and self-hatred and bigotry and prejudice. Often the kindest things we experience in life are the moments in which someone cared more about who we were than how our feelings would be hurt to tell us the truth that saved us or showed us some otherwise invisible reality. Often the way we are kindest to ourselves is by saying no. Often the things we are most grateful for, the ones that were and are the most trying, the most deeply compelling, the most wholly changing, even if at first they aren't necessarily comfortable. So you should say no when you want to say no. You should speak precisely and kindly and with understanding but directness when you see a friend struggling to make a simple choice that will have a profound effect on their entire quality of life, instead of walking away and discussing with everybody else but them. You should leave your house if in it you're not wanted. There are ways to pay the rent. There is no way to make somebody love you when they don't. You should say how you feel before it stays in the darkness so long that it becomes the foundation on which the rest of your life is built, and then collapses through. You should tell the people you love that you love them. You should tell the people you don't that you don't, and let them find people who really do. You should dig deep into the untouched abyss of yourself and see what you come out with. First, it will be the unhealed wounds you didn't know you had. Second, it will be the light and love and passion under which they rest. Third, it will be the desire to take those things and run with them and build something remarkable. You should evaluate your choices not in light of how other people will perceive them, but how in line with your deepest, truest self they are. You should rise and say, "This is who I am," even if you'll crucify me for it, in the very way so many religious and political and social idols and icons have, even if their fans and followers are the very ones who will do the crucifying. You should give to others what you need most, which more often than not is to say the following: you are not loved by everybody, but that does not mean you are not loved at all. You are not the most beautiful, but being the most beautiful is not what matters most. You are bound by nothing but your own fear, so you will not find freedom anywhere but within yourself. Everybody suffers. Not everybody comes out on the other end shimmering and ready to let that light reverberate through the dense and otherwise impermeable darkness. Not everybody has the guts to be truthful, but everybody has the capacity to. And the greatest irony, the most profoundly cunning thing of all, is that the very love and passion and acceptance we are seeking resides nowhere else but within our own unbridled honesty. So go to it, and let it finally breathe. 65. 7 reasons why heartbreak is often crucial for human growth. There have been so many poets and thinkers and philosophers who have spoken to this idea, the purpose of suffering, the wound through which Rumi claims the light enters. The beautiful people, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross says, had to know defeat and suffering and struggle, to know appreciation and sensitivity and understanding. The pain Khalil Gibran believes sears the most incredible characters' hearts. The suffering through which Fyodor Dostoevsky claims a large intelligence and deep heart can be born. The people see Joybel C. sees as stars, dying until they realize they are collapsing into supernovas, to become more beautiful than ever before. Heartbreak may not be responsible for fundamental biological human growth, but rather the kind that we also know in our minds and of our hearts and throughout our souls. If the philosophers couldn't speak to it well enough, surely you've experienced something of the same strain in your own life, the pain that was crucial to the process, the things that were lost to prepare for those that would be gained, the excruciating experiences that made you who you are now. It's a phenomenon so many people talk about, but most can never quite define. The catalyst that breaks you open. The rock bottom on which you build the rest of your beautiful life. The suffering that was somehow so crucial, you're grateful for it when all is said and done. It's the human equivalent of metamorphosis. The darkness against which we can finally see light. It's my belief that if we could understand why our pain is necessary, we could bear it with more grace, or at least learn to listen to it before it forces us to. Here, the 7 reasons why heartbreak is often necessary for human growth. 1. Suffering is only necessary until we realize it isn't, but it usually takes something to make us realize that. Pain and suffering are not the same thing. I'm sure you've heard this before. We love pain. We make the same expression during an orgasm as we do while being tortured. Crying is cathartic. The physiological sensation of pain ultimately keeps us alive. It's suffering that we don't like. Suffering is a resistance to pain, and it's in resistance that we suffer. We don't choose what pains us, and that's a good thing. We do choose what we suffer for, and that's even better. It was always only of our own volition. 2. Human beings think they are seeking happiness, but they are seeking comfort and familiarity above all else. People are incapable of predicting what will make them happy. This is because all we know is what we've known. Our culture, however, is big on planning for the future, choosing our happiness and chasing it. In an effort to do this, we just choose something we knew from the past, even when objectively it isn't happiness at all. It was something we desire more, comfort. Until our loyalty to our comfort zones becomes too uncomfortable to bear, we won't be forced to seek something genuinely greater than whatever it is we once thought was best. 3. Suffering teaches us that trying to change the external world to be happy is like trying to change the projection on the screen rather than the projector that's playing it. Byron Katie speaks to this beautifully. Once we realize where the lint is, we can clear the lens itself. This is the end of suffering and the beginning of a little joy in paradise. She is referring, of course, to our minds, and the fact that we don't realize to turn inward until we dig ourselves deep enough into a dark hole of trying to change what's outward. Your mind is the lens through which you perceive the world. You must adjust its focus to change your life, not the opposite way around. 4. Often suffering comes to us in the form of a breakdown, which is really just a breakthrough that we haven't seen the other side of yet. Through learning that sometimes, oftentimes, we don't know what's best for us, and yet somehow, our subconscious instinctive selves do. I'm not claiming to know that there's necessarily a divine intervention responsible, but I am claiming to know that many times, even in my own life, I somehow knew when it was time to break my own heart for the sake of something greater, even though I didn't know what that greater thing was at the time. 5. A capacity to feel joy must be balanced by a capacity to know pain. Our world is born of and exists because of duality. This is a fundament of our natural world, but it's also important to see in our own lives. The truth is that the greater capacity you have for darkness is as much contrast through which you can see light. The yin-yang of our emotional selves is always in balance. It truly just depends on what perspective we choose to view things through. Both are equally available to us. The choice is always, ultimately, ours. 6. Pain is a signal that something's wrong. Suffering is what happens when we don't heed it. Physiologically, of course, this is true, but it's even more true emotionally and mentally. We almost like to create problems for ourselves out of a very deep belief that we deserve pain, the bad kind, out of retribution for how terrible we, wrongfully, believe ourselves to be. It's only through grappling with that pain that we realize it was always self-induced and served mostly just to help us unlearn our need to create it, to realize why we don't deserve it, and in the process of doing so reconnect with who we truly are, not just what the rest of the world sees us to be. 7. The universe whispers until it screams. There is no traumatic experience that is ever a completely singular event. There is no heartbreak that is ever just the cause of one thing. It's the pattern. It's what the loss compounds on. It's the final hit that breaks us open. The moment when we realize that we knew what was true all along, though something prevented us from heeding the calls early on. That is what we break through when we break open. How beautiful to live in a body and world that allows you to explore the darkness, but pains you when it's time to come back. How wild that nobody tells us about this until we're in it, or already almost too far gone. 66. Why we hold on tightest to the things that aren't meant for us. I used to wonder how you let go of the things that are killing you, when it feels like it would kill you to let go. How you decide between if things are meant to be, they will be, and if you want it, you have to go get it. I think we hold on tightest to the things that aren't meant for us because at some level, we know they aren't really ours. We're always seeking the love we know we don't have. We're always trying to prove the things that are not entirely self-evident. We know that when we stop thinking and talking and racking through the details again and again, it will really be over. When all that exists is an idea, holding on is the only way to keep it. Because letting go has little to do with giving somebody permission to leave our lives, or declare that they don't love us anymore, or walk away for good, and everything to do with accepting that they already have. I don't know about fate, but I do know the things that are ours don't require us to mentally and emotionally latch on to them to remain. That the best things are never forced, are never created out of ultimatums, never leave us reeling and questioning them for months or years at a time. I do know that you cannot prove how much you love by how much you're pained over loss. That you do not prove your character by how well you can convince other people you're doing the right thing. And I do know that it's never the love that hurts you. It's the attachment to the idea of what it's supposed to be. I do know that we will never be able to find real love unless we learn to detach from what it should be. I do know that we're never going to find true happiness until we do the same. I do know that nothing here lasts, and the idea that it does is an illusion. We eventually lose everything, every last thing we have and are and own. So the point isn't what we lose, but what we had in the first place. We aren't meant to attain things like bullet points on a resume. We're supposed to go through them and let them go through us. Some love teaches us what it has to teach us in a month, some a lifetime. Neither is more important than the other. The things that are meant for us are the things that force us to stop seeking an external light, but to start becoming it. The things that are meant for us are trying and joyous and beautiful and excruciating. They're the things we don't think about. The things we don't have to hold on tightly to make happen. 67. Things your 20s are too short for. 1. Letting anybody convince you that because you're young, you're incapable. Plato began his career in politics before he was 20, and has stated that he faced ridicule in his coming of age for that reason. Some of the greatest cultural tycoons of the century were in their 20s when their first huge contributions were made. Jobs, Zuckerberg, etc. Imagine where we'd be if they listened to the people who said, "What do you know?" 2. Arguing with people whose intentions are not to understand you, only to prove themselves right. You do not owe it to anybody to carry on a conversation that is only serving the ego, but you do owe it to yourself to step out of the inevitable frustration and self-doubt of interacting with people who don't listen to understand, but to respond, who don't speak to be heard, but to defend. 3. Wasting your energy placating the habits of people who don't take the initiative to actually get their shit together. Often the most frustrating thing about dealing with someone who is going through a tough time is that they aren't willing to listen to reason or logic, or even simply your opinion. You end up having to pretend. You nod along with whatever they're saying because you don't want your every interaction to turn into a fight. The resentment will build, and the relationship will crumble anyway. 4. Justifying your choices to people who only care about how you look within the context of their lives. The people who will squawk the loudest about what you should and shouldn't do, or how you're on the wrong path, or whatever else they couldn't possibly have the grounds to know, are usually the ones most concerned with how it makes them look, and how they're going to explain you to friends or cousins or sisters or family or co-workers. Remember that while you're deciding who matters, and while we're on the topic. 5. Remaining in contact with people you don't like because you should, because it's more convenient, because you'll feel guilty if you don't, because you're too afraid of what someone will think if you're finally honest with yourself and other people. You do not have to waste your life bending over backwards to make people happy when they don't and wouldn't do the same for you. 6. Holding on to love that's already run its course because you fear the best has passed you or you won't find anybody who makes you feel the same way. The purpose of most great love is to gut you open, teach you what you need to know, and send you on your way to bigger, better, even happier things. Don't let your irrational fears talk you out of letting yourself find that. 7. Eating food you don't like, keeping plans you don't want, staying digitally connected with people who annoy you, hoarding clothes for a someday that never comes, and putting your life on hold for someone who does not and will never want to commit. The amount of life we waste gathering and holding on to the things that will never really serve us does one thing and one thing only, keeps us away from the things that matter, that bring us joy and purpose and meaning for that much longer. 8. Not taking time to figure out what you want, even if it's to be okay with knowing you're not sure and don't need to be. Don't let the fear of not finding something definitive keep you from finding anything at all. You'll be running around in the circles somebody else drew for you so long as you don't take the time to reflect and evaluate and really connect with that core inner knowing that screams when you come across something you know is what you're meant to do or be or become, even if it's just for a day, an hour, a year. 9. Not taking the time to heal the wounds of your childhood. The things that have molded you will be constructs that you, and only you, will have to dismantle for yourself. The time to do this will either be now, while you're still adaptable and developing, or later, when your unhealed walls are forcibly knocked down by powers greater than your own self-control. The choice is yours. It always will be. 10. Judging people for things that seem wrong. Every single thing serves a purpose. The goal is not to create a seamless image. It's to go through the experiences that need to grow and teach and change us. You don't know that a completely wrong and illogical marriage is what someone really needs. You don't know that there's no element of fate or destiny involved in the birth of a child that seems young and for which the parents seem ill-prepared. You don't know that the people who seem to be doing nothing with their lives are gathering the knowledge and experience that will one day write the next great American novel, uncover the next great philosophic idea, etc. As hard as it may be to grasp, all things are good, because all things serve us in the way of growth and development. 11. Never taking the initiative to learn how to live within your means, whatever your means might be. It doesn't matter how much or how little money you are making, how many investments you have or savings accounts that are stacked or absolutely empty. It doesn't matter how much or little debt you still have to pay off. If you are not already in the mindset and lifestyle of living within the means you have, the same financial problems will follow you no matter where you go or what you achieve. 12. Putting the things you want most off until it's more convenient. If you're looking for a reason not to, you'll always find a reason not to. If you're looking for a way how, you'll always find a way how. 13. Burning bridges over minor frustrations, bridges that could have led to jobs or relationships you didn't know you'd want or need. While you're in this weird period of infinite opportunity and inevitable uncanny irony and serendipity, you're in no place to assume that you're not going to need every last contact you've got. If you must walk out of something, learn to do so gracefully, so the door won't be locked if you need to walk back in. 14. Staying at a job where you're miserable. I'm not saying it will happen tomorrow. I'm not saying you'll find your dream job in a week, or even a month, or three, or six. I'm saying that anybody who has accomplished anything they really wanted at a young age had one thing in common. They were at the right place at the right time, because they were consistently putting themselves out there. To create your own luck, up your chances, and have faith that some greater destined force will do the rest for you. It sounds like a loose argument, but please, trust me. 15. Staying in a relationship in which you secretly get the sense that you're settling because there's nobody else around. Similar to how terrible temporary jobs become a terrible 10 years at that same job before you do anything about it. Relationships you settle for become marriages you settle for, etc. 16. Not experimenting with your appearance because you're afraid any one change will define you as a whole. There are two things that would benefit you to do here, and those are to get really goddamn comfortable with the body you're stuck with, and get really goddamn comfortable with that body changing, because it's only going to do so from here on out. Some of that change will be within your control, most will not. Don't let yourself be so attached to one way of appearing that you make your inevitable growth and aging even harder for yourself. 17. Never learning to say sorry or thank you, not for the sake of how it will make you look, but because you are able to recognize the ways in which you could have done better and the things for which you're humbled. To your parents, to your exes, to your teachers, to strangers, friends, family, the people you once knew, but most importantly, to yourself. 18. Not ordering pizza at 4 a.m. or eating cake for breakfast at least once, or kissing a stranger, or giving the person you've been eyeing across the bar or cafe your phone number, or taking a road trip and sleeping in the car with your best friend, or whatever other slightly irresponsible but ultimately harmless thing you're tempted to do, but most times don't have the guts to. Do it. 19. Waiting for something outside to fix your inside. For the next year, job, relationship, paycheck, piece of clothing, new apartment to fix whatever discomfort or dissatisfaction you feel. The latter will follow you into the former until you fix it on its own terms. Always. 20. Only wanting happiness. There's so much more in a life than just feeling content all the time. The most important things you'll experience will have little to do with your happiness. They'll be about suffering, and heartbreak, and joy, and panic, and fear, and love, and what you come out as having been through those things. You will not remember the days when you were just okay and happy. You will remember the moments of joy, and the pangs of ache, and the things that were defining and changing, and miraculous and incredible and made you feel alive. Stop numbing your life because you're afraid of yourself. The only beast there is to tame is the one who doesn't want to really live. 68. The happier you are with a decision, the less you need other people to be, and 11 other things truly fulfilled people know. Fulfillment may seem like the elusive desire that's driving an entire consumerist market, but that's only because some smart people are capitalizing on something inherent of us all, or at least inherent of us by the millions. We all have an aching desire to live a meaningful life, and yet none of us seems to know how. Somewhere along the line, we confused happiness for what we have, as opposed to what we do. We thought that the solution to an incomprehensible emptiness was to fill everything else around us. Needless to say, this has mostly, if not entirely, failed. To be truly fulfilled is to be happy because of your own self-realization. It is to come to such a genuine understanding of what you want that not doing it isn't an option anymore. It's seeing beyond the mindsets you adopted or the ideals that are not inherently your own. It is the humble simplicity of what you want to offer the world each day, and it is the love you awaken as you do it. 1. Success is falling in love with the process, not the outcome. It's making your dreams about the journey, about the doing, about the day-in, day-out routine and minutia. The life you want is within the simplicity of your everyday tasks. You can't only focus on writing the synopsis and then wonder why you don't have a book yet. 2. Only some happiness is valued in society. Not everybody will applaud that you left your job to work at a coffee shop because it's what you love. There is really only one kind of happiness that society values, and that's the kind that society is comfortable with. The kind that is far enough removed from genuine contentment that nobody feels pressured to consider how unfulfilling their own lives are. Do not let other people's demons decide what your happiness is. Do not let other people's fear of them make you afraid too. 3. Love and success are not expendable. They're not non-renewable resources. Someone else's doesn't take away from your own. This belief registers for most people in elementary school. We see that some people are popular, and some people aren't. Some people can be happy, some can't. This is often what begins the lifelong competition that only ever exists in our heads. Someone else's success doesn't make you less successful. Someone else receiving love or praise doesn't mean you aren't love or praiseworthy. You are not only as good as you are better than someone else. 4. the happier you are with a decision, the less you need other people to be. The happier you are with what you do, the less you need other people to support you. Ironically, it's also in being happier with what you do that you'll find the support you were looking for before you knew how to give it to yourself. 5. The end goal is to see how the simplest things are the most extraordinary. When the end goal is to have something tangible, the end goal has not actually been identified yet. Tangible goals, money, books, job titles, and so on, are mile markers. They are the products of your life, not the goals of your life. The goals are to be truly fulfilled. The book you write to do that is not your fulfillment. It's one expression of it. Don't confuse the radio for the sound wave. 6. You don't have to, you get to. This is one of the simplest changes in perception, and yet also something truly fulfilled people master, the knowing that everything is an opportunity to experience. You don't have to go to work. You get to go to work. You don't have to wake up early. You get to wake up early. When you start considering things not as obligations, but as opportunities, you start taking advantage of them, rather than trying to avoid them. 7. Easy does it, and does it well. It's a phrase used so frequently and yet rarely ever with understanding. Anything that is genuine and wonderful and most probably successful is effortless. The state you're in when you're creating will be what the outcome is. The more ease and love you put into it, the more other people will get out of it. 8. Anything that exists in your life exists because you created it. Anything that persists does so because you are feeding it. Consider this. Every one of your actions feeds something within you. It feeds your desire for control, your love for your job, your spitefulness toward your sister, your complacency with your marriage. Every action creates and compounds upon something that already exists. With this in mind, ask yourself what it is you feed each day. Your life will make more sense if you do. 9. It's not about whether or not you listen to yourself. It's about what part of yourself you listen to. Most people find it almost impossible to listen to their instincts because they don't know what they're saying, or worse, they've listened to them before and they've been destructively incorrect or short-sighted. That's because at any given time, there will be many different voices that drive you to different outcomes. Your immediate instincts may be geared more toward protecting you rather than expanding you. They could be speaking out of a place of lack or fear. You have to ask yourself, what is the root of this reaction? Where does it come from? And what is its outcome in the long term? 10. Even when you justify your judgment of people by how right you are, you're still wrong. It doesn't matter how awful someone is being, or how correct you are in your takedown of their mental-emotional state. You're still wrong for doing it. It's not your job to police for the universe. It's your job to take care of why you feel more comfortable attacking assumptions you make about others, rather than the assumptions you fear they're making about you. 11. Your soul knows what to do to heal itself. The challenge is just to let it. Most mental and emotional healing comes from first completely addressing the problem. You'll find that throughout your life, you'll create situations again and again that all but force you to address some long-standing issue. That's because you don't necessarily want to torture yourself, but that you want to address it and bring it to your conscious awareness so you can deal with it and let it go. Trust in your nature. It knows more than your physical mind. 12. You probably can't be whatever you want, but if you're really lucky and you work really hard, you can be exactly who you are. Which is all most people ever want anyway. grandiose visions of being something spectacular and spectacularly removed from someone's skill set and personality, etc., can be measured in proportion to how much they feel they are lacking. The funny reality is that people who accomplish incredible things never think of them as incredible. They think of them as normal. It's that integration into normalcy that makes it a pattern, which makes it a routine, which makes it a habit, which ultimately makes it a product. That drive and consistency is born of one thing and one thing only: doing something in alignment with who you truly are. It is a privilege, albeit an extraordinary challenge, to awaken to yourself. Even more so is to have someone who loves that person, a job that utilizes that person, and a life that fully realizes that person, even if you denied them along the way. 69. What people who have lost love know. The people who have lost love know that someone else's love isn't yours to lose. Someone else's love is yours to experience. But anything beyond that is just becoming attached to an idea, a hope, a big ol' supposed to be. The people who have lost love know that right there is the point at which you lose yourself. When you start believing someone else will carry some part of you with them when they walk away. When you start seeking salvation in the very person you have to be saved from, believing that someone else, someone other than yourself, can save you. The people who have lost love know that you can lose things you never really had, and relationships that never really started, that never ran the course of all the dreams and plans you had together. They know that you can mourn people who were never really there at all. The people who have lost love know what it means to fill the empty spaces in your bed with pillows, and in your life with work or dates that don't matter much, or just the acknowledgement of sadness. They know the therapeutic quality of embracing it. They know what it means to be absolutely certain there is no feasible way you could ever love somebody as much as you love that one person. They know what it's like to have your concept of logic and sense and justice and fairness and supposed to be turned all the way on its ass. They know that you don't always spend forever with the person you love the most, but you can spend forever trying to reconcile that fact in your mind. And more importantly than those things, they know that moving on isn't a conscious choice, but rather what happens when you stop trying to, when you stop forcing yourself to forget. You forget about them when you start thinking about you. They know what it's like to look back on the things they thought they'd never get over, and to realize that even the hardest things somehow dissipate with time, ease with understanding, release with awareness. They know there's incomparable strength in having seen yourself through the worst. They consider their actions before they're reckless with other people. They know what it's like to be on the receiving end of carelessness. They become the gentle lovers and cautious suitors whose hesitation and timidity might be confused for indifference, but it's not. And this is significant. They gain a reverence and an understanding of just how deep a human heart can love and how fragile an ego can break. The people who have lost love know that tight, stinging, burning feeling in your chest and throat and legs. They know what depths panic can drive you to when you've exhausted every option. They know that soulmates aren't what people think they are. They aren't happily ever after most of the time. They are a love that lights every part of you up and exposes the unhealed layers. Your true soulmate is the one who shows you to yourself. And they know that's the point. They know that you can love a person, but never as much as you can miss them. They know what it's like to have no choice but to live in the moment, to have to mentally walk yourself through every hour of the day, because otherwise your awareness will be pulled from sifting through what happened and worrying about what will and wondering about where they are and if they even cared at all. They know to appreciate what they have while they have it. They know that there may be no deeper pain than seeing someone you love be in love with someone else. Or more accurately, someone you thought belonged to you suddenly belonging to someone else. That simply. For all the great oceans of depth that you could feel running between you, that it can be over in a simple drop. They know what it's like to carefully daydream running into that lost love again. They know what it's like to be picking out clothes with them in mind, rehearsing conversations alone in your bedroom, cutting their hair and running a mile longer as though a simple shift of appearance could make someone fall in love again. They know what it's like to actually run into them when they're with someone else, someone else who is in so many ways not what they are, for better, for worse. From that extraordinary pain, they learn that someone's love for you isn't lessened or greatened by how much they love someone else. It's not a singular, expendable thing. And that knowing this may be the greatest lesson of all. They know what it's like to live with the ghost of what would have and should have and maybe still could be. To be walking down the street with a constantly running narrative of what they'd be saying, what they'd be thinking, if only they were there. To be out at the bar when the conversation seems to drift from your awareness, and all of a sudden all you can focus on is a faint thought of what it would be if they were sitting next to you. To be holding your basket in line at the grocery store and hear your song come on, and all of a sudden to be imagining all the ways you once thought they imagined you and how they must think those very same thoughts, send those very same texts, act that very same way, just with someone else. They know what it's like for there to be strangers in the world who once knew everything about you. They know that you somehow always call into your life exactly what you need, the most painful, the most changing amongst it. They know you never lose love. They know that what you experience, how you grow, what you take and learn and see and do because of it, is the point. Not to have it forever, but to become what it was meant to make you. They know that, at first, you'll spend your time trying to figure out what to do with all the love that is left lingering. And they know that you're supposed to give it to yourself. 70. Simplicity. Learn to like what doesn't cost much. Those are the things worth your time. You can buy your way into things and places, but you can't actually buy the experience of them. It's not what you do, it's what you perceive. A meaningful life isn't how often you can saturate your senses, but how you grow to think of even the simplest, most unassuming daily things. Learn to like reading, whatever it is you like to read. Learn to like talking and people, even when they're not the same as you. Learn that truths can coexist. That's the one thing that will set you free in this world. Learn to like simple foods and cooking them. Learn to like fields, trees, camping, walking, fires, watching the daybreak and end. Learn to like writing and burning candles on rainy summer early evenings. Learn to like clean linens and washing dishes and hot baths and drinking water and long, meandering drives. Learn to keep your needs simple and your wants small. Learn to breathe deeply, to taste food when you eat it, to sleep deeply when you sleep. When you laugh, let it carry on until you're sweating and out of breath. When you get angry, get really angry. Just let things burn through you. The less you push these things away, the less they come out in inappropriate and debilitating ways. It's not anger or the sadness that controls you. It's the resistance of it that keeps them tucked in their place in your soul. Learn to let negative thoughts drift back to where they came from. Nowhere. Do the things that are effortless. Let them be effortless. Find love that's effortless. You'll be instructed to believe that success comes from grueling, soul-bending hard work. But that's more something we impose on ourselves. Because letting effortless things also be successful ones makes them feel unmerited. That's how we create problems where there are none. Decide to keep nothing but what is meaningful and purposeful. When you cycle and circle around your space, touching, seeing, and using only things that evoke a feeling of security, purpose, meaning, joy, your everyday life becomes grounded in happiness. When there's not enough to make a mess, no more than you can clean and wash and handle, everything feels settled. Complexity is often the easiest choice. It's easy to let ourselves get wound up and bound down to the ways we let our thoughts and fears run narratives into storylines, into realities we live out. Simplicity is difficult because it requires clean thinking. It's the long, hard way to a cleansed perception that is not shadowed by conditioning or negative thoughts. But it's yours, and yours always. You can keep all of 100 belongings for the rest of your life, and every one of them will be used, broken, replaced, taken, thrown out, rendered obsolete. But your perception of how meaningful and useful those temporary things were, how much you appreciated and enjoyed them, that's yours. And that is what choosing a life rooted in simplicity does. Makes the ordinary miraculous. People like to make big claims of what will bring you happiness, and happiness in some form is what we're all seeking, even if we don't place that word on it. Stability, love, money. Happy psychology, the phenomenon of the last 25-plus years, has come about really for the fact that we pioneered a country for the sake of unbridled, radical happiness, religious liberation, freedom, democracy. Yet these things, these houses that hold us and companies we run, these relationships we fail at because we're constantly expecting them to be more, the desire to max out pleasure, has not made us happier. Because we have not changed how we think, and that's the only real change that ever happens, because it's the basis of how we feel. The magnitude of one's life is directly parallel to how deep their perception of it is. Your life grows as you do. What you experience is a reflection of what you are. Do not forget that you do not have forever to do this, to change this. It's easy to let another day, week, month, year slip by, letting yourself keep seeking the light in people and money and more and more and more. It's easier to spend that time seeking the light in yourself because you think that's the right thing to do. You don't find the light, the ability to perceive, because you already are it. The work is getting rid of everything that stands in the way. 71. 18 little reminders for anyone who feels like they don't know what they're doing with their life. 1. Nobody knows what they are doing with their lives. Some people have a better idea of what they're working toward, but ultimately, none of us can accurately anticipate or summarize what our existence is about. Not yet. 2. You decide what your life is defined by. The feeling of being lost isn't what happens when you go off path. It's when you forfeit control. It's what happens when you don't want to accept the course of events that have unfolded. Being found again is a matter of owning what happened to you and continuing to write the story. 3.